China summons the U.S. ambassador in Beijing in strong protest at House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's, quote, egregious visit to Taiwan. Leader of the Hezbollah resistance movement has slammed the U.S.'s empty promises for supplying natural gas and electricity to Lebanon, saying nothing has happened after a year. And Yemen's warring sides agreed to another two-month extension of truce, vowing to intensify efforts to secure lasting ceasefire in the war-torn country. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. China and the U.S. are on a collision course as U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi lands in Taiwan, and Beijing has slammed Washington's action on the self-ruled island as extremely dangerous.
The United States constantly distorts, obscures, and hollows out the One China principle. These moves, like playing with fire, are extremely dangerous. Those who play with fire will perish by it.
Beijing has vowed targeted military action in response to Pelosi's visit. U.S. House Speaker landed in Taipei Tuesday evening. She's the highest-ranking American official to visit the island in 25 years. Now, upon arrival, Pelosi said that her visit shows Washington's strong commitment to Taiwan. She also said that she is in no way violating the One China principle. Now, earlier, Russia also slammed the U.S. move and expressed full solidarity with Beijing.
We see this visit, which I don't know what to call it, as well as the possible or potential trip of U.S. House Speaker Pelosi to Taiwan as another provocative action by the U.S. administration to put additional pressure on Beijing.
Russian officials said Moscow considers the situation in the Taiwan Strait as a purely internal Chinese matter. Iran also slammed Pelosi's visit, calling it an interference in China's internal affairs. Tehran has reiterated its full support for the One China policy. Beijing considers Taiwan part of its territory and opposes Washington's growing engagement with Taipei. Before Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, China warned the U.S. will pay a price for undermining Beijing's sovereignty if this trip takes place. Meanwhile, China has summoned the U.S. ambassador in Beijing to voice strong protests at Nancy Pelosi's trip to Taiwan. China's vice foreign minister described Pelosi's visit to the island as an egregious in nature, warning of extremely serious consequences. He added China will not sit idly by in the face of Pelosi's provocative move. She added that the U.S. shall pay the price for its mistakes. He urged Washington to take practical measures to undo the adverse effects of Pelosi's Taiwan visit. The official emphasized Taiwan belongs to China and will eventually return to the motherland. Leader of the Hezbollah resistance movement has slammed America's empty promises for the transfer of natural gas and electricity from Egypt and Jordan to Lebanon. Said Hassan Nasrallah said a year has passed since the U.S. ambassador's promise, but nothing has happened. He added the movement had promised to buy fuel from Iran to meet Lebanese energy needs, but U.S. didn't allow that to happen. Nasrallah said the U.S. and Israel are the embodiment of the devil, and Hezbollah's struggle against them will continue. Nasrallah's remarks came 2 days after he issued a stern warning to Israel about exploiting Lebanon's offshore energy resources. Nasrallah said the resistance movement is ready for any scenario, including war, to protect those interests. Dispute between Lebanon and Israel escalated in early June after the regime sent a drilling ship to the Kadish gas field in the East Mediterranean. Lebanon has dismissed Israel's claim that the field falls within its so-called exclusive economic zone. Parties involved in the Yemen war have agreed to extend now a four-month-long truce for another 2 months, just hours before it was due to expire. Announcing the extension, the United Nations said renewal of the truce includes a commitment from all parties to intensify efforts to reach an expanded ceasefire. UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Hans Grunberg, said the objective of the truce is to provide tangible relief to civilians and pave the way for a peaceful settlement to the conflict. The UN-sponsored truce has been the longest respite that Yemen has seen during the war and has persisted despite multiple violations from the Saudi side. It came into effect April 2nd and was renewed on June 4th. The U.S. says it is selling new missile defense systems to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates worth more than $5 billion. The State Department said that Saudi Arabia will buy 300 units of Patriot missile systems, which can be used to shoot down long-range ballistic missiles and aircraft. A Saudi order is worth over $3 billion. According to the department, new missiles will be used to defend Saudi Arabia against drone and missile attacks from Yemen. Separately, the UAE is buying $2.25 billion worth of THAAD missile systems. Both countries have been targets of retaliatory attacks by Yemeni forces. U.S. and its Western allies have been under constant fire for their huge military assistance to Saudi Arabia and the UAE in their destructive war against the people of Yemen. War has killed thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire country into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Israel has been has a bleak track record of harassing human rights activists advocating Palestinians' rights. And now UN experts have issued a statement blasting Israel for mounting pressure on rights activists and Palestinian villages across the occupied West Bank. We earlier discussed this issue with our guests in our news review program.
Time now for the news review. UN experts blasting Israel for harassing human rights defenders and humanitarian workers in Palestinian villages in the occupied West Bank. In a joint statement, four special rapporteurs call on the regime to stop harassing those who are seeking to support and protect people in the Masafar Yatta area. They say Israel is acting with impunity and often detains or confiscates cars and documents of rights defenders on the ground of entering the restricted site. The statement says residents also continue to be threatened by the risk of mass forced evictions and arbitrary displacement. Masafar Yatta is home to 19 Palestinian villages, but the area was declared a military zone by Israel in the 1980s. The regime frequently evicts Palestinians and rights activists from there, citing different pretexts. Okay, let's get some insight on this. Joining me will be Khaled Barakat, who's a journalist and activist in Vancouver. Also with us is Mick Napier, who is with the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Edinburgh. Good to have both of you, gentlemen. Let me start by asking Khaled, tell us about the Masafar Yatta. Why should it be declared as a military zone? Because, you know, under different pretexts and excuses, the Tel Aviv regime is confiscating Palestinian land, destroying their homes, ignoring them, the permits that they say they lack, and on that ground they simply raise the building and the structure to the ground. And now we have this Masafar Yatta area, and they say this is a military zone, and there are 1920 Palestinian villages there.
Yes, this is a classical example of how Israel practiced ethnic cleansing and slow transfer of the Palestinian population. And since 1948, this is not a new policy. And if you look at most of the land that was confiscated in the West Bank by Israeli regime, it's always have used these kind of pretext and fake justifications that this is a military zone. Sometimes they confiscate land for reasons that had to do with the security or with the environment, and they come up with all kind of reasons in order to achieve their policies of more land, less Palestinians. Now, in the case of Masafar Yatta, these are Palestinian Bedouins and peasants who have been facing the atrocities of the Israeli military, but also the Israeli settlers, because settlers are kind of a paramilitary groups, and they are the ones who also, with the Israeli army, try to make the lives of Palestinians in Masafar Yatta a living hell. And this is it's known to Palestinians. They did this in the Jordan Valley. They did this in many other areas in Palestine. And so Palestinians and supporters of Palestinians, including UN personnel, are being subjected to all kinds of oppression because Israel noticed in 1999, and that was the end of the so-called interim era of negotiations with the PLO, they evacuated 1,000 Palestinians from Masafer Yatta. So ethnic cleansing, war crimes is happening in Masafer Yatta, as well as it's happening in the entire Palestine from the river to the sea.
Okay. Now, Mick, definitely it's a good thing that the United Nations, the four rapporteurs, they're all asking the Tel Aviv regime to stop harassing and put into trouble all those people who are trying to help the Palestinians in the Masafer Yatta area. But, you know, the evictions are happening there. UN staff, as Khaled also mentioned rightly, they're also being put to trouble. And any other person who is trying to kind of be of any help to Palestinians there. So this is a good thing, I mean, by condemning such thing and asking the Tel Aviv regime to stop this, but it doesn't seem to be enough, does it?
No, I mean, Khaled's described very well and very eloquently how this is an example of a much more widespread, geographically widespread, in fact, across the whole of historic Palestine, inside 48, inside the West Bank, and also historically from before 48, but of course accelerating since then. And the Masafer Yatta chapter is a horrible chapter, but it's merely one in a very long book. This is ethnic cleansing. If you look up closely, I mean, the excuses, as Khaled said, which the Israeli government puts forward are, of course, not... A child could see through them. Sometimes they're very humanitarian. They want to set up a nature zone to protect nature. And, of course, Palestinians have to be moved. They have to train their army. Therefore, Palestinians have to be moved. And so on, and so on, and so on. Look, we need to look up close at what's happening in Masafer Yatta and at many, many other places. But we also need to stand back and look at the big picture. The Palestinians, the Israelis have made no secret of the fact that they want, and they think they already have 100% of Palestine, and the Palestinians are surplus to requirements. They should be driven out of Palestine, but if they cannot be, they have to be concentrated into smaller and smaller, poorer and poorer areas until final expulsion can be achieved. And it's a full spectrum of oppressive measures which are used. We know about the killings usually, sometimes by the hundred, sometimes just one or two or three or four per day. But not a day has gone by since the Israeli state was founded that dispossession hasn't been moved forward. And look, in this situation, the Israelis are very sensitive to international opinion. They look at what's going on in Washington. They also look at what's going on inside the EU, and they decide if they have a green light or not. They don't pay too much attention to the condemnations in words. Mm-hmm. And as far as the UN is concerned, there has been report after report by well-meaning staff of the UN describing the measures taken against the Palestinians. Measures against Palestinians that could never be taken against Israeli Jews.
Right.
And they report this very fully.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, your initial report talked about Israeli impunity. And we're just past, only a few weeks ago, just as the examples are multiple, but a few weeks ago, the UN Security Council published its list of shame.
Right.
They looked at 21 countries where a lot of children are killed by brutal means. And Israel came top. Guterres said that Israel had killed almost 100 Palestinian children last year. I think it was 80.
Right.
And maimed and wounded almost 1,980. But Israel was kept off the list of shame. And we find this example after example of Israel getting an exemption, an impunity that no other country possibly gets. And it's not just nuclear weapons. Iran is being sanctioned for having a nuclear energy policy, but Israel's hundreds of hydrogen bombs, of course, are exempted from any discussion. So yes, the UN and the Arab regimes in the Middle East, which are normalizing with Israel, are giving Israel a green light. And you know, in a struggle for existence that the Palestinians are engaged in, morale is everything. And when the UAE and Saudi Arabia move closer and closer to Israel, they're rubbing salt in Palestinian wounds. But also when we see support for the Palestinian struggle from everywhere in the world, then that can sustain Palestinian morale against a brutal regime of ethnic cleansing. And, you know, it's still open whether the Palestinians will win or lose, but there's every reason to think that they can win if we can build enough international support for their incredible struggle.
Okay, and that's all the time we have. Thank you, my guests, Khaled Barakat in Vancouver, Mick Napier in Edinburgh.
NARAL says it's been injecting hexafluoride gas into hundreds of new advanced centrifuges in response to latest U.S. sanctions targeting the country's trade sector. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says U.S. cannot get concessions from Iran while resorting to such measures. He also urged Washington to stop its excessive demands. Amir Abdollahian noted Tehran is serious to continue talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. He stressed, however, that his country seeks a good, strong, and lasting agreement. A top Iranian diplomat added Tehran will not sit idly by if Washington continues to follow down this current path. On Monday, the U.S. blacklisted six companies claiming that they help Iran export petrochemicals to East Asia. Later in the day, Iran began injecting gas into hundreds of centrifuges, including advanced IR-1 and IR-6 machines. Thanks for joining us, and goodbye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The logic behind Imam Hussein's uprising. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, left Medina for Mecca on 27th of Rajab 60 AH, but before setting out, he wrote a letter to his brother Muhammad ibn Hanafiyyah. He wrote in a part of the letter, "This is a testament which Hussein, son of Ali, writes and gives it to his brother Muhammad ibn Hanafiyyah. I testify that there is no deity except the one Creator, and I bear witness to his oneness. And I testify that Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, is God's servant and God's messenger and was sent from God. I testify that paradise and hell are true and the day of resurrection will occur and there is no doubt in it. And I testify that God will revive all the dead. Then Imam Hussein, peace upon him, explains the motive for his movement as follows. O God, be witness and let others know that I have not started this movement as an ambitious, pleasure-seeking, seditionist, and unjust person. Rather, I seek reform in my grandfather's ummah. I want to bid what is good and forbid what is evil. And I want to act according to the practice of my grandfather and father. Imam Hussein's words and the words of other imams are the best and most reliable documents to reveal the logic behind his movement. Revival of genuine Islam and cleansing the distortions from Islam were the motive behind Imam Hussein's great movement. The distortions and innovations which had happened during 20 years of Muawiyah's rule had turned into principles, and the religion of God was on the precipice of total collapse and annihilation. Yazid, the licentious son of Muawiyah, was the corruption incarnate. He was the embodiment of every evil and sin. If Muawiyah would pretend to be religious to deceive masses, Yazid wouldn't observe religious codes and principles even in public. In his Hajj pilgrimage, Yazid took part in drinking and revelry near the mausoleum of the Prophet in Medina. Officials and influential figures were opposed to Yazid's succession of Muawiyah, but they agreed with this issue out of the fear of Muawiyah. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, seeing the depth of perversion and corruption in the Islamic Ummah, understood that there was no way except a great revolution to salvage the whole Ummah. In one of his sermons, the Imam said to Muslims, and indeed all free-spirited people in history, "Do you not see that truth is not practiced and falsehood is not forbidden? In such conditions, a faithful should wish to meet his Lord by death." In one of the texts of Ziyarat, or standard form of salutation of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, we address the Imam with the words, "I testify that you made God's halal as halal and God's haram as haram. You maintained prayer, gave zakat. You bade what is good and forbade what is evil. I testify that you practice fairness and justice and invited to these too." One of the great concerns of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, was the silence of influential figures against the corruption and deviation of the Umayyad regime. In fact, their silence and seclusion from the social affairs had set the ground for spread of corruption by the ruling system. Had the course of leadership not changed after the Prophet, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, wouldn't have been forced to stand against corrupt rulers at the cost of sacrificing his life and that of his companions and captivity of the children and womenfolk of the Prophet's progeny. In view of this,
Before leaving Mecca for Kufa, Imam Hussein delivered a very strong and fiery sermon among a group of ulema and elites of various Islamic lands. In this sermon, the Imam seriously censured the taciturnity of ulema against anti-religious policies of the Umayyad regime and called any compliance and compromise with the regime as an unforgivable sin. Then he clarified his motive of uprising. O God, you know that what we have done has not been for rivalry and competition in ruling and excessive demands of the petty material of the world. It has rather been done for demonstrating the signs of your religion and revealing reform in your lands. We want your oppressed servants to be secure and your obligations, traditions, and laws to be practiced. The public negligence and inattention to innovations and corruptions of the Umayyad ruling system also was a great concern for Imam Hussein, peace upon him. The Imam thus started his movement to revive insight among people and awaken their hearts and minds. If they distinguished between truth and falsehood, they would choose the right path. Imam Hussein stood against Yazid to the last drop of his blood to awaken dormant consciences. In another ziyarat for Imam Hussein, we address God with the words, Hussein sacrificed the blood of his heart to salvage your servants from ignorance and bewilderment of misguidance.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIV English Radio. A very warm welcome to your own program, Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in the studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Brother Sheikh Miqdad, who is a researcher in the Hawza Ilmi of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome. Today, we would want to discuss with you an issue many parents do have. One of the questions that I want to ask you is that there's a 12-year-old who is struggling with sleep and is so messed up. How do parents deal with this?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So sleep is very important, especially at this very sensitive age of teenage, 12, 13-year-olds. Sleep kind of, the whole body goes through change, right? Physical maturity, body goes through change. So sleep is very important that we take care of it. Couple of things. One, obviously, at this age, children tend to become lazy, mm-hmm. right? Teenagers go through a stage where they become kind of lazy, where they want to increase the level of sleep. I remember when they're very young, they wake up at 6 in the morning and parents are kind of pulling their hair out. Why do my kids wake up at 6 in the morning?
Yes.
But then when they turn 15, when they're 13, 14, 15, children don't wake up until 11 a.m., 12 noon, 1 p.m. And then to parents, again, I'm putting the hair off, that my child is so lazy, doesn't wake up until half the day is gone. We kind of have to hit the middle ground where it's natural for these teenagers to kind of perhaps require more sleep. But we have to be careful and make sure that they also have their exercise and they're also very active during the day. That will really help them too. So how do we do this? One is that together understand how much really a child needs sleep.
Okay. Right?
And you realize that usually 12 to 13-year-olds, 8 hours and above becomes more. They don't need that much. They're very likely we can go and sleep 11 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But they don't need it. They themselves will tell you, yeah, but that was a bit laziness. That was just because I didn't have anything else to do. So one is to always kind of together with a child, with this teenage boy, discuss how much hours of sleep do you need. Usually it's between 7 to 8 hours, maybe a bit more, sometimes 8.5, but more than that becomes. The second thing is the time of sleeping. Again, teenagers love to stay up all night.
Yes.
Right? Slowly, you want to discourage that. Try and help them to understand the value of sleeping at night, waking up early in the morning, the value of doing things in the morning rather than at nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very difficult challenge. Today's world somehow is sleeping very late at night and waking up late in the morning.
Yes.
Amongst the things you can do is make sure that they have activities starting very early in the day, activities that they like. So for example, if your child loves football, organize football at 8 a.m. Right.
Okay.
If your child can get some work going, especially in summer, for example, if they can do some activities that they really enjoy, make those things happen early in the morning. So they're kind of forced to sleep early at night.
Okay.
And those activities that they can do, that they're doing at night, if they can be moved to the morning and the afternoon, that would be ideal. But again, I understand this is sometimes very difficult. Balance it out. If you can, if it's very difficult, one of the other solutions you could do is have nap times.
Okay.
So they can sleep late at night, still wake up in the morning, early in the morning, and then have a bit of nap time in the afternoon. But that's very difficult because by nap time, we mean half an hour.
Yes.
Maximum an hour. It should never be 3 hours of sleep, especially not on a full stomach after lunch.
Especially, yeah.
So we have to be careful of those kind of things. So play with a very important kind of notion of sleeping early at night, waking up early in the morning. But obviously in difficult challenges, things kind of arrange to help that happen as much as we can.
Well, we need to manage that as parents. What else we can do, I'll ask you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
Hey, stop! I got a favorite game!
IRIP English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Brother, you said that we need to manage time even in the afternoon naps. We have to make sure that it's for half an hour or so, but not for 3 hours for us. I personally, talking about teenagers later on, I personally have a child, a baby boy who is 7 years old, almost 7+ now. And he is if I ask him, if I try to tell him, please have an afternoon nap, because there's so much play, make mess around. And if I personally want to take a nap, I would first request him to go for a nap. And my son would answer like, the sun has not switched off yet. He understands the concept like we have to sleep only at night.
Yeah.
So there are even kids, especially boys, they really hate sleeping, be that at daytime, that at nighttime. What else can parents do to deal with them?
I would say it's a very good thing. Children to be saying that I don't want to nap. See, nap is only a requirement. So if children don't have to nap, then don't nap them.
True.
Ideally, they shouldn't even nap if not necessary.
Yeah.
And for a child to say, I don't want to say, I know what you mentioned, my 7-year-old hates sleep, whatever time of the day it is. And he says this explicitly, I hate sleep, right? But when he sleeps, obviously he sleeps quite a lot. But they do. It's a very normal thing. It's actually a very good thing. Children are full of life, basically. They want to be active. They've got a lot of things to do. It's very good.
Yes.
As a general principle, especially in teenagers, the more active they are, the better.
Yeah.
You want to literally tire them out, right? If you want your teenagers to go through a very good puberty period, okay, just knock them out, right? Like, do so much activity from morning to afternoon that they really get tired.
Okay.
Plenty of sports, right? Plenty of intellectual activity. Just keep them busy, on their toes.
Recreation.
It shouldn't be that they feel like, oh, I'm bored, I've got nothing to do. You've got a couple of hours of no work. No, that shouldn't be the case.
You mean to say, like, if I want my child to have sleep at early, I want my child to sleep early and wake up early, I should make sure that he also does not have a sedentary life.
Exactly. Yeah. Sedentary life is very much detrimental for a good sleep.
Okay.
Another point, I'll mention 2 points and I'll move into a more important one. One of them is sleeping on a full stomach, especially teenagers. That should be avoided at all costs. So if you have bedtime, make sure bedtime is at least an hour or two after dinner. And again, if you're napping them as well, make sure that you're napping them at least either before lunch or a bit after lunch, not straight away on a full stomach.
Okay.
And secondly is the important point I want to mention is having a sleep routine is very important as well. The activities before sleep really have an impact on quality sleep.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about quantity of sleep, how much a child sleep. But also remember, quality sleep is important, if not more important. So sleep routine, many things you can talk about. So firstly, obviously, sleep routine means that you have a number of items of things that you do and you don't do before sleep.
Okay.
So for example, having routines like going to the bathroom, brushing your teeth, doing wudu, especially at that age, they can understand the concept of doing wudu before sleeping.
This way you can introduce the concept of changing your bed into the mosque.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, as the hadith mentions. And then wearing pyjamas, basically. So that's kind of 4 or 5 items they do before sleep.
Yeah.
Psychologically, what happens is that the brain mentally prepares itself for bed. They know if they do this for 2-3 months, okay, what will happen is that the moment they do these four things, they naturally feel tired and they finally feel ready to go to bed.
Okay.
Another thing is, what are they doing before sleep? So screen time, avoid screen time an hour or two, if not more, before sleep. Screen time doesn't help a lot. In fact, it's not just for kids as well. It's for adults as well.
Never sleep with
your phone next to your bed. Always switch off your phone an hour or two before bed.
Okay. So screen time is also important. How is that important? I'll ask you that again after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "No father has granted a gift to his child better than good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Brother, you were talking about screen time.
So screen time, from a physiological perspective, the studies out there, you can Google it, you'll find it, how screen time affects sleep patterns.
It's there.
The light from screen and other factors as well leads to kind of not a messed up sleep pattern, but doesn't play a good role in sleep quality.
And that way they also become addictive.
Addiction to screen time isn't completely another matter. Obviously, you want to avoid them to be addicted to screen time. But in terms of sleep, having your phone on or having screen time an hour or two before sleep will actually have a detrimental effect
on
your
sleep
quality. reading books and doing story time before sleeping is very good.
Okay.
So if you can encourage teenagers, 12, 13-year-olds, even before that as well, to read books before sleeping is not a bad thing.
Okay.
Having a reading culture at home is very important.
Okay.
But obviously, always monitor what they read. Mm-hmm. Encourage good books to be read. Even if it's novels, encourage good novels to be read. Good children's books to be read. Monitor that as well. But definitely have a reading kind of culture, even before sleep, is good. It's part of a good routine.
Okay.
And last point is sleeping and waking up kind of requires a mental decision as well.
Okay.
So teach your children, especially at least 12, 13 years, as your question you mentioned was a messed up sleep pattern, teach them and tell them about the power of your brain and the power that you have to kind of make a decision to sleep and make a decision to wake up. I'm not saying that it's completely in our control. Obviously, Allah is the one who brings about sleep and wakes us up. But for our body to be prepared to go to sleep, we need to make a decision. So children who say, okay, I know I'm going to sleep at 10 o'clock or 11 p.m., for example, make a decision that I'm going to sleep at 11 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
It'll help them sleep better. And again, waking up, same thing as well. Remember, at 12, 13, they should be waking up for Fajr already now.
Yeah.
And that should actually be a habit by now to be able to wake up at 12, 13. So if they have an alarm, make sure that they put them the alarm themselves and that they train themselves to wake up for Fajr. If they sleep after Fajr, it's not a big deal. They can sleep after Fajr, but they do wake up for Fajr. They make a decision before going to sleep to wake up for Namaz of Fajr.
Yeah.
And same thing, they make a decision to wake up in the morning at what time.
Yeah.
It should never be the case that you sleep in the morning, sleep at night, and you say, I'll wake up whenever I wake up.
Yes.
Right? If that happens, then you'll be sleeping until 12.
Yeah.
Teach your child, say, whatever time you're going to sleep, say, decide what time you're going to wake up.
Yeah.
It's fine if it's half an hour late or an hour late. That's fine, right?
Yeah.
But you've decided that I'm going to wake up at 6 o'clock. I'm going to wake up at 7 o'clock. I'm going to wake up at 9 o'clock. They make this decision.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like I'll wake up whenever I wake up and that's it. You just go and laze about.
Well, that was also a nice point. And parents can also help their children understand that sleeping time is a time when a child has to analyze what good he did, what bad he did throughout the day, and he can avoid bad things and they can encourage him doing good things again. Thank you so much, brother, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIV English Radio. This was Islamic Upbringing. In case you have any questions for us, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until another session, fi amanallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The U.S. president's recent visit to the occupied Palestinian territories paved the way for an escalated crackdown on Palestinian human rights advocates and journalists in the West Asia region. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Biden Helps the Zionist Regime Get Away with Murder. Here's more. The U.S. president's recent visit to the occupied Palestinian territories paved the way for an escalated crackdown on Palestinian human rights advocates and journalists in the West Asia region. During his perfunctory visit to the occupied Palestinian territories, Joe Biden said that the U.S. will continue to insist on a full and transparent accounting for the killing of journalist Shirin Abu Aghaleh. He did not elaborate on what such an accounting would look like or what form Washington's insistence might take. The president's vague pledge was belied by his much more specific commitment to shield the Israeli regime from accountability. That promise was made in the Al-Quds U.S. Israeli regime strategic partnership joint declaration that he issued with Yair Lapid, the Zionist regime's prime minister, a day earlier. Integral to that pledge is Washington's commitment never to allow other countries to acquire nuclear technology, and that it is prepared to use all elements of its national power to ensure that outcome. The U.S. also pledged to seek additional missile defense assistance for the Zionist regime during exceptional circumstances, such as the Zionist regime's military offensive in Gaza in May 2021. More than 250 Palestinians in Gaza, which has been under the Zionist regime's blockade since 2007, with no end in sight, were killed during those 11 days of bombing, including at least 67 children. Around a dozen people in other parts of Palestine were also killed as a result of rocket fires during those 11 days. Palestinians lack an advanced defense system like that used by the Zionist regime to intercept rockets fired from other parts. 14 Palestinian families lost three or more members in a single attack during that offensive as the Zionist regime targeted residential buildings. UN independent human rights experts have stated that, owing to the vast asymmetry of power, the victims of this conflict are disproportionately Palestinians in Gaza. Biden pledged to perpetuate this asymmetry of power by stating that he would continue to help the Israeli regime stamp out at any and all Palestinian resistance, armed or otherwise, to Israeli regime occupation, colonization, and apartheid. Washington affirmed that it would work with Tel Aviv to combat all efforts to boycott or delegitimize the Israeli regime, to deny its right to self-defense, or to unfairly single it out in any forum, including at the United Nations or the International Criminal Court, ICC. That promise directly contradicts Biden's purported insistence for accountability for Shirin Abu Aghaleh. Abu Aghaleh, a U.S. citizen and veteran Al Jazeera correspondent, was fatally shot while covering an Israeli regime military raid in the West Bank city of Jenin during May. On July 4th, a major holiday in the U.S., the U.S. State Department issued a statement acknowledging that Abu Aghaleh was most likely killed by Israeli regime fire. The statement, attributed to spokesperson Ned Price, added without any elaboration that U.S. officials found no reason to believe that this was intentional. The UN Human Rights Office also concluded that Abu Aqile and her colleagues, who were wearing protective vests and helmets, marking them as press, came under fire from the direction of the Israeli regime forces. But in contrast to the U.S. State Department, the Human Rights Office noted that several single, seemingly well-aimed bullets were fired towards them, suggesting that the shooting was deliberate. The U.S. State Department even appeared to justify the Israeli regime's military action, saying that Abu Aqile was killed as a result of tragic circumstances during an IDF-led military operation against factions which followed a series of attacks. The joint declaration signed by Biden and Lapid implies that efforts to hold the Israeli regime accountable in international fora such as the UN and the ICC unfairly single it out. The declaration rejects the Palestinian-led movement for boycott, divestment and sanctions, and in the next sentence says, the U.S. and the Israeli regime will fight every scourge and source of anti-Semitism, implying a link between the two where there is none. The declaration also pledges to respond whenever legitimate criticism crosses over into bigotry and hatred or attempts to undermine the Zionist regime's legitimate place among family of the nations, as they claim. Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group, said that the declaration is the latest continuation of the Israeli regime's protracted smear campaign targeting Palestinian civil society organizations supported by the U.S. Rather than repairing the world, as Biden and Lapid claim in their joint declaration, the pact will further entrench the Israeli regime apartheid, according to Al-Haq. Al-Haq is one of six Palestinian organizations declared as terrorist group by the Zionist regime last year on the basis of secret evidence. The foreign ministries of several European governments that fund those organizations issued a rare joint statement ahead of Biden's visit to the occupied Palestinian territories, rejecting the terror designations and affirming their support of the targeted groups. Nearly two dozen U.S. lawmakers wrote to Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, to express their serious concern for the six Palestinian groups. A reported lack of evidence to support this decision raises concerns that it may be a deeply repressive measure designed to criminalize and silence prominent and essential Palestinian human rights organizations, the letter from the members of Congress led by Ayanna Pressley states. The U.S. must condemn any effort anywhere to undermine life-saving humanitarian work. The lawmakers urge Blinken to publicly reject this decision and call on the Israeli regime to reverse course. More than 140 organizations signed on in support of the letter, including the six Palestinian organizations, Human Rights Watch, Oxfam America, the Israeli lobby group J Street, and Presbyterian Church USA. Evidently, Biden did not raise the Zionist regime's terror designations against the Palestinian groups, a widely condemned move during his visit. Three of those groups, including Al-Damir Al-Haq and Defense for Children International Palestine, are closely engaged with the International Criminal Court's investigation of war crimes in the West Bank and Gaza. They are likely being targeted because of that work and not despite it. Thank you.
Biden's reaffirmation that the U.S. will help the Israeli regime undermine the ICC investigation can only be seen as a tacit endorsement of the criminalization of the Palestinian groups representing victims at the court. Reassured that the U.S. will combat efforts to burst Israeli regime impunity at the UN and ICC, Tel Aviv is surely feeling emboldened to escalate its repression. The Israeli regime war ministry reportedly sent a letter to three lawyers representing some of the six Palestinian organizations stating that they may be in violation of Israel's terror laws for collecting fees from the groups. Reporters like Shirin Abu Aghile are also more vulnerable after Biden's West Asia region tour. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, the U.S. effectively shrugged its shoulders over the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, did not push for the release of journalists jailed in Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and did not commit to an FBI-led investigation into the killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aghile. Sharif Mansour, a program coordinator with the Press Safety Watchdog, stated, adding, "Journalists in the region and the world are sadly more vulnerable after this trip."
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.